Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, a study from the National Children's Hospital showing that personal care products, the type of products you keep around your bathroom and without thinking, well, they send a child to the emergency room every 2 hours. We have about 15 items on health and healing today. Then we have a special original in-depth investigative report and commentary, and I'm going to share that with you, and it's needed. And I'd like for you to please share this with as many people as possible. The report is all about where America will either have the will or not to combat global warming. In effect, we are engaged in institutional and personal denialism. But I'm going to break it all down. And this one report will give you a view of the entire world and what's going on. And then following that, we're going to have a guest from the United Kingdom, a unique individual talking about the rise of the new authoritarians. He is Professor David Renton, R-E-N-T-O-N. He's a British barrister. He specializes in discrimination and employment law and political activism. And he was an academic historian and sociologist, specializing in fascism and right-wing movements, having taught at Nottingham Trent University, Rhodes University. And he's written on the subject. And he also is a graduate of St. John's College at Oxford University, as well as a doctorate from the University of Sheffield. So we're going to find out why there's so many right-wing and left-wing corporatists who are acting as if they have a right to be the ultimate authority figures in all of our lives. Also, over the weekend, I came up with an idea that I believe should give us an entirely new perspective, radically new perspective. I've never heard it shared before. If it has, good, but I believe that this will be the first time you've ever heard this concept. I won't say more than that. It'll be on hopefully tomorrow. So that's it. I don't believe we'll have time for other commentaries, but if we do, we'll get to those as well. We always start with the latest on health and healing. And according to the National Children's Hospital, when you go into a person's home, there are dangerous products hidden in plain sight on your bathroom counters, your bedroom dressers. We're talking about personal care products like shampoos and lotions and makeup and nail polish and cologne. They seem like they should be safe since they're intended for use on our bodies. However, in the hands of young children, these products can quickly lead to trouble. So a new study conducted by the Center for Injury and Research and Policy at the Nationwide Children's Hospital, they found tens of thousands of young kids, 5 years and younger, treated in United States emergency departments for injury related to these products. This was published in Clinical Pediatrics. So here's just the message. If any product you have could be swallowed by a child, simply put it out of their reach. It's that simple. Okay? Next up is from London Imperial College. Magic mushrooms could replace antidepressants within 5 years. So according to researchers from the world's first psychedelic research center, Center for Psychedelic Research at London's Imperial College, the actual chemical in magic mushrooms could replace prescribed antidepressants in short order. And we've also heard something similar from John Hopkins University, which suggests victims of emotional trauma may experience more long-term relief when using natural chemical fungi instead of chemical drugs. Professor Robert Harris, head of the research center, is leading one of the first trials to determine how therapy involving the mushrooms, which are currently illegal in the UK, compares to leading antidepressants. Now, in my research, I spoke with the Dr. James Duke, and just so you know, Dr. Duke for decades was America's leading herbalist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and he was the go-to person. I visited him on several occasions, including at his home, and he had one of these remarkable backyards, hundreds of herbs. He knew every single one and what it did, and it's one of those ooh-ah moments where you're not expecting to see something that magnificent, beautiful, and healing. I also, during that same period of time, I was communicating with a Dr. Norman Farnsworth, MD, PhD, University of Illinois, who had the largest repository of peer-reviewed studies, actual scientific studies on herbs. And he had, at that time, over 100,000 studies. And between the two of them, they were the top two people in America. And both of them told me that when you look at native cultures that have used different psychedelics, including magic mushrooms, they use them to help people who have experienced trauma when nothing else would work, and they have worked. But it's a leap to go from when something is claimed in, let's say, in some form of natural healing in folklore versus testing it to see, is it true? And if so, what parts of that particular plant or root or leaf or twig hold the ingredients? So that's being done now. And I'm concerned because each day between 20 to 22 American veterans, all to over 160,000, kill themselves more often, not just blowing their brains out. Almost all these people were on psychiatric drugs. Almost all of them had been to their doctors in the armed forces, then at the VA. So it's not as if it was a rare situation. Now, I've interviewed hundreds of veterans who have been on psychiatric medications. I have some holistic protocols to get them off, to help them with get off the post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, to help them if they suffer from Gulf War syndrome or if they've had exposure to the vaccines, including botulism and anthrax, among others, and with some degree of success, in some cases, complete reversal of conditions. And then I look at the scientific literature and I say, okay, if millions of American veterans are being receiving these antipsychotic medications, clearly there's a large body of evidence showing that it helps them. Indeed, there's no evidence showing that it helps them. So they've been lied to. So this is one more way that we might be able to help them, in addition to the cannabinoids that have also helped people with post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll keep you abreast of all the latest findings in that study. From Baylor University comes a new study about the gut bacteria could be one of the most important things you could do for slowing down the aging process. And they're testing thousands of genes one at a time to determine the impact of what is in our gut. In fact, there's a whole library on the bacterium E. coli. And they're just each lacking one of close to 4,000 genes. So when you feed a bacteria into the gut, you'll see some response on the existing bacteria. And the latest science, as of today, shows that good bacteria is created from good foods, and mainly plant-based foods. You do not get a good bacteria. You get a bad bacteria when you're eating animal proteins or sugar or refined carbohydrates. Now, these bacteria have to be in large enough amounts to make a clinical difference, what we call functional. I remember 12 of the leading scientists in the world all had something in common back in the, I think it was 1972 or 3. I brought them all together to the Waldorf Astoria, to the Grand Ballroom, and it was packed, where these people all had invented supplements. Like Albert Szent-Jordi won the Nobel Prize for discovering ascorbic acid. There was actually one other person who did it a little earlier, but he certainly was one of the most important. There was Dr. Williams from down in Texas University. He had discovered like three of the B complex, Dr. Ellis. And from Canada were the Shute brothers. And all of them said the same thing. that if you take a supplement in too low an amount, you will not see any functional outcome. If you take in a large enough amount, then you're going to start to see what it does in its physical manifestation. And that stuck with me because I remember doing a debate. And in the debate, the man held up some scientific papers and said, "You see, there's nothing here. This is all nonsense, all this vitamins." And he was one of the quackbusters. And I said to him at the time, "You're looking at the wrong part of the problem. You're accepting that the scientific literature is up to the same level of awareness of functionality of nutrients as the clinicians. Now, what you do not have here are the feedback of all the doctors in America using much higher doses of vitamin C and B-complex. And I use the example of two. I use the example of vitamin E. And I said, now the Shute brothers, both doctors, cardiologists from Canada, they found that you really start getting the benefit of vitamin E at 800 units. And you, in some cases, they've gone up to 2,000 to 3,000 with gangrene with remarkable results. And I brought with me their scientific papers and showed before and after of gangrene how it was reversed with vitamin E internally and topically. And then there was a doctor down in, I believe it was Reidsville, North Carolina, Dr. Frederick Klenner. And Klenner was using about 50,000 milligrams of vitamin C and getting remarkable results. But he was just one physician, and no one knew what he was doing outside of, you know, the people who might have known him. But I knew him, and I spoke with him. And so that's what I was finding, that the scientific community, I don't believe, was intentionally biased. I just believe that the information they had in their studies, using 15 units of vitamin E, 30 milligrams, you heard me right, 30 milligrams, less than what's in an orange, of vitamin C is all you needed. When indeed, we needed massive amounts depending upon the condition. And that's why I started doing studies that I could do at the Institute of Applied Biology and started working with people at Trafalgar Hospital, which was cross-street and affiliated, and helping people reverse disease. And it was interesting because initially the director of the institute said, "Gary, I'd prefer you not discuss this at the monthly meeting when all the scientists get together because this is just considered too radical." I said, "Well, what's radical? You saw Ms. Stern." Ms. Stern was my editor at a very big, famous publishing company. I didn't even know she had cancer until I saw her in one of the wards, and I put her on this diet, and it reversed. And I said, "You saw that she was dying. You were one of the people recommending, as an expert in cancer, that she go into hospice care. You see now that she's completely well. What do you attribute that to, except for what was done?" "Well, you know, you could have spontaneous remission." I said, "Fine. Prove it. Prove it. Prove to me that a person who has a full end-stage disease will go completely back to normal, meaning no cancer whatsoever. Show me the study. I've studied the scientific literature. I can't find one. Saying that you will go without symptoms for a period of time, like multiple sclerosis, yes, you can. But it doesn't reverse the disease. That's a different statement, and yet they're commingling the two factors. They conflated remission with reversal. Let's be very clear. When you reverse a disease, it's no longer a matter of remission. They no longer have the disease. Whereas if you can simply slow down the manifestation towards an end, generally senescence or death, yeah, that's in the scientific literature. So in any case, he still insisted that I not discuss this. Now think of that for a moment. That men and women, experts in their field, highly qualified, but have cured no one, they couldn't handle that a lifestyle modification change, changing the diet, a plant-based organic diet, juicing, lots of enzymes, probiotics, helping the person rebuild their intestinal milieu, overcoming autotoxemia, rebalancing the acid alkalinity of the body, that in time you could reverse the disease. They had never seen that. Therefore, they didn't want to know about it. Now, go to that concept I've been talking about, mentioning, and hopefully you're more aware of it today, that good people, smart people, people who are excellent in a field, who are knowledgeable, even with advanced degrees, even including in chairmen of departments. I know because I have friends who have chairmen of departments, but will not look for the truth if that truth would challenge their existing position of rightness. So I came up with a term called intentional neglect. So you're intentionally, not by accident, you're intentionally not going to open a door. Let's say you're a pro-vax person. And by the way, the latest screed from the Washington Post says that anyone who is an anti-vaxxer should be arrested and put in jail, their freedom taken away from them. Now, just stop for a moment and think of that. You've had three children, true story. You're a medical doctor, true story. You're a pediatrician, true story. Your first child, you vaccinated and ended up with autism. You did your research, thousands of hours, and realize you've been lied to. Therefore, you choose with intentional awareness to know the truth. That truth liberates you from continuing being intentionally ignorant, because when you intentionally neglect something, then you're going to be ignorant of the consequences. And if you're ignorant of the consequences because you didn't want by intent to know the truth, then you're going to look and blame the world or act like a victim of something that, had you done your homework, had you intentionally wanted to know the truth, you'd have found it. Because the truth is easy to find. It's not hidden. But it's easier to stay in the comfort of our epigenetically programmed mindset that we're right, you're wrong. There's us in you, and you're wrong. How do you know? So now that woman doctor who suffered from a child that she has to take care of the rest of his life, she wanted to protect her other two children. She was very remorseful. She felt terrible because she said, as a pediatrician who had vaccinated thousands of children, I should have known better. I should have done my homework, and I didn't. So now they want to take that woman and arrest her and put her in jail, probably put her children in foster care. That's the Washington Post. That's the level of Jeff Bozo, who is intentionally ignorant on just about everything except making money. And that's what they want to do. So they're trying now to weaponize the term anti-vax. You got to see where this is going. I just had a conversation yesterday. He says, Gary, don't talk in complications because the audience won't understand what you're saying. You've got to really tell the people who to vote for or they won't know how to vote. And I'm thinking, my God, that is so condescending to the people in this audience. I've got a highly, highly proactive audience, the largest in the world, progressive thinkers. Who does this man think he is that he knows my audience? He doesn't know my audience. My audience doesn't have to be told what to do. I would never stoop to the level of telling people, you got to vote for this person. I don't tell people who to vote for. I'll show you the comparisons and how people use power when they were in office, what they did and what they didn't do. You know, those are simply tools to help. But we're not all intentionally unaware, intentionally ignorant, and as a result, the consequences of not knowing the truth, intentionally injured. In any case, it was only after I simply one day decided I couldn't tell anything to anybody because they were not yet willing to understand that there are other truths, not just theirs. So it was only when I came up with this idea, and boy, do I have a radical idea for tomorrow. Whoa! Tomorrow, you got to tune in tomorrow, because tomorrow you're going to hear something you've never heard in your life, ever, any of you. It's going to be one of those paradigm shifts in our consciousness. It's going to be one of those ooh-ah moments. Wow. Okay, now I get it. I see it. That epiphany is going to happen tomorrow. But for today, just imagine how frustrating it is that I'm doing something they can't do, because not because they're stupid, they're not, but because they're not willing to look at the fact that doing more of the same is not going to change their previous failures into future successes. I'm just looking at disease differently. I'm looking at what's actually causing it, and then what can we do to fortify the body's natural immune system. And something as radical, as heretical, as demonic as bean sprouts, wheatgrass juice, an apple. Boy, that, I ought to get a scarlet letter for that. Let's have the new McCarthyism. The Democrats are demonizing everything. Boy, what a party. Jeez, when I get my guest on in a few moments, I'm going to ask him about what the hell happened to the entirety of the liberal democratic corporate community. They've gone to hell in a handbasket. They're utterly as corrupt as the Republicans. Completely. Totally. But I'll let him address that. Now just imagine science is no better. Your doctors know better. The television advertising executives know better. The board of directors that makes the profit at the network from those ads for drugs that are actually side effects kill people. You have an allergy, your nose is runny, we don't want that. Take this drug. Oh, by the side effects, you can die. I'd rather have a runny nose than die. Well, your allergies, surely you want the drug. I can deal with an allergy, but the side effects dying. And that night's sleep, well, again, death. Why is it that arthritic pain? Death. All these things, death is a side effect. When did death become an acceptable side effect? Because it's not a side effect. It's an effect. Once again, we have put into a utopian spin that everything is good except the side effects. Well, do you have any guarantee? Will you give me a written guarantee that I won't have that side effect? Oh, no, we can't do that. But we're sure it's safe and effective. Will you give me a written guarantee that if this vaccine injures my child, you'll pay out of your pocket for the rest of their care, for the rest of their life? Oh, no, we can't do that. But you're now trying to demonize anyone who questions after being intentionally aware by doing their homework that somehow there's something wrong with them. Do you see where this is going? Do you see what they're doing? In any case, just understand that when you have healthy bacteria, which you will not get from their diet, advertised on their television shows, with their people advocating this crap, you're going to end up sick and speed up the aging process. But reverse that, fill the body with healthy, good bacteria, and you can prevent disease and turn on the entire healing process. Also, talking about the healing process, Penn State University came up with a study from the American Cancer Society that says grapes can kill colon cancer stem cells. You want to kill the stem cell of cancer. That's the progenitor. So here's what you got to know. That compounds from grapes can kill colon cancer stem cells, both in a petri dish and in mice. And the compound is, guess what? Ready for it? Resveratrol. Wow. Found in the seeds and the skin. So, you mean what a lot of you have been taking, you unaware people? Yeah, no, not this audience. You're sharp as a tack. You're clued in and you're focused. You pull back all the curtains and you didn't need Toto to do it for you. And you see the truth. And you've been using resveratrol. So what you could do to help reverse a disease, if it's natural, non-toxic, you can use to prevent a disease. Works the same way. And a new study from St. George University in London shows that cannabis can kill leukemic cells. A new study has just confirmed yet another positive use of cannabis. And the cannabinoids can successfully kill leukemia cells. That's important. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a quick break and come back, and I've got a special commentary for you. And I want you to share it with as many people on as many sites as you can. Please stay with us.
You are my pride and joy.
I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world and all of our syndicated stations. Thank you very much for providing a forum for this show. We do more original commentaries than any other radio program in American history. This week I have 5 coming at you. This is just the first. The full article is published and on PRN.FM, Progressive Radio Network's homepage. Download it and share it. It's been legally vetted. It's been vetted for scholarship. And it's by Richard Gale and myself. It's entitled, Where is America's Will to Combat Global Warming? And this means we're dealing in personal and institutional denialism. What do I mean? At this very moment, exceptional climate and environmental events are underway across the planet. Greenhouse gas emissions have already passed 440 parts per billion threshold and continue to climb towards the 2 degrees Celsius benchmark sooner, much sooner, rather than later. The idea that we have 100 years, we don't even have 5 years before you start seeing parts of the world so ravaged by the events of climate change and tipping points that you're going to have massive amounts, hundreds of millions of environmental refugees. And right now, there's no place for them to go. There's no preparation for them. There's no food for them. There's no lodging for them. So we're not ready for this. The catch-22 is that carbon emissions and severe climate-related catastrophes are increasing simultaneously. Extreme events such as droughts and floods demand more energy. Hotter days require more air conditioning, while colder days demand more heating. Consequently, emissions rose 2% in 2018. That's the highest increase in over a decade. But during the past couple of months, all of South and Southeast Asia has experienced blistering, record-breaking heat waves. In May, India's town of Palauli hit 123.9 degrees Fahrenheit. That is a killer temperature. It causes relentless water shortages and deaths from heat stroke. Villages have been forced to go without drinking water for days. In the United States, there has been an unprecedented swarm of tornadoes, over 900 different tornadoes since the start of the year. And during a 2-week period in May, 200 ripped through the states from New Jersey to Texas. Likewise, massive flooding occurring right now in the Mississippi, the Arkansas rivers, the Ohio rivers, the Missouri rivers are devastating farmlands across Midwestern states, from North Dakota to Louisiana. And it's being reported as the new face of climate change by the University of Notre Dame. These trends provide sound evidence to confirm a recent Helmholtz Center for Polar and Marine Research observation that the warming Arctic is directly impacting alterations in the jet stream in its current, which is over the northern hemisphere, and giving rise to extreme cold and then extreme heat in the lower altitudes. Now, you've heard this mocked repeatedly. Oh, it's 20 below zero out. You know, where's those global warming people at now? These people, unfortunately, have chosen to remain stupid. Not difficult for the deniers, but had they looked, they would have found out that the extremes come from the same cause. If this is not fearful enough, reports about conditions in the Arctic and Greenland and the Antarctic are becoming more dire. If you have been listening to this program for about 8 years, then you would have heard some of the beginning of our series on the environment and the tipping points. I said that I had interviewed people for a film that is just now finishing. It's in post-production as we speak, who said we are in chaos theory, that there is no accurate mathematical model anywhere on the planet by any scientist that can predict when something's going to melt or what the temperature will be or what the consequences are. All those are artificial models, and they're shown to be way off. Now that we're reporting that Greenland is melting, they just lost 2 billion tons of ice, and it's melting much faster, up to 3 times faster. There are parts of Antarctica that are melting 7 times faster. So this is not going to be anything other than absolute chaos when it starts to happen. And that is what is happening. In fact, according to the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which is in Switzerland, they are one of the people telling us it's all accelerating. In the United States, the loss of the remaining glaciers is more rapid than what anyone predicted. It was established long ago that glacial loss will create extreme water stress for hundreds of millions of people and alter weather patterns and further contribute to sea level rise. In May, a study published in the journal Nature warned of the rapid thawing of the northern climes, permafrost. The threat has been largely ignored because it was perceived earlier as a crisis in the distinct future. Don't worry about it now. Well, the paper out of the University of Guelph in Ontario noted that a collapse of the tundra and the release of tons of methane would, quote, transform the landscape in mere months through subsistence, flooding, and landslides, end quote. Scientists at the Holwoods Research Center predicted that the warming of Alaska is occurring so rapidly that, quote, the numbers of people needing relocation will grow, the costs are going up, the people's lives and cultural practices will be impacted, end quote. At this very moment, 45% of Greenland's massive ice sheet is melting, an enormous increase from the 10% melt that is normal at this time. Entire ecosystems, primarily huge tracts of forested lands, are also toppling faster than predicted. That same month, the UN's Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services Assessment of Extinction Rates was announced. The study was based upon an analytical review of 15,000 scientific papers. The report concludes that nature is globally declining at rates never before witnessed while humans have inhabited the Earth. About 1 million animal and plant species now face imminent extinction, and certainly within the next couple of decades, due to humanity's adverse impact on the environment. All of these reports and events should have made top headline news. None of them did. We're being told endlessly that there is time to correct and mitigate the climate threats. But as climate journalist Robert Hunziker remarks, where is the leadership to spearhead the necessary corrections to our economic system and way of life? Aside from the approximately 17 million educated Americans at your professional class, now add on to that your 10 million millionaire class, and now you're up to about 27 million. But now, take the fact that the average family is about 2.7. So if we took 27 million, and just for our argument's sake, just say 3, you're dealing with 81 million people who are the ones doing most of the purchasing, doing most of the traveling, the ones who could afford private jets, and the ones who want the hardwood everything without realizing you have to take down forests that might have been hundreds of years in growth, and you're planting softwood trees in their place. There's not going to be a good carbon sink reality check here. So where is our professional class, the scientists, lawyers, doctors, engineers, professors, accountants? When have you seen them leading marches or giving their voice to them? When have you gone into any medical doctor's office? There's about 1.3 million physicians, around 780,000 actually practicing today. The rest are retired. And when did you see them handing out information on what they could do to be healthier going on a plant-based diet, but also help lower the carbon footprint? You haven't. And you won't. And that's the unfortunate part of this. These are intelligent people. These are highly educated people. These are the professional class who are intellectually capable of tackling the climate problem to devise solutions, and yet only an infinitesimal tiny circle are not distracted by lower priorities. The larger faction, the vast majority of our professional policymakers and opinion leaders who are fully aware of global warming's immediate threats, like Al Gore and other neoliberals, will only promote solutions that will benefit them personally, and as long as the fixes do not interfere with their energy consumption and lifestyle and behaviors. As a result, effective solutions seem to remain far off into the future. If this is the case, then it might be game over. Do I believe it's game over? Yes, I believe it's game over. Do I believe we're all going to end up in that same boat? No. No, societies do not collapse all at once. But when the environment begins to collapse, which it is, like look in Bangkok, look in many of the places where the ocean is taking back the cities, they're having to move entire cities, then those who have the resources will move, those who have the will move out of harm's way, and those others will just be victimized. So we don't have time. And that's why I believe that we're not even having a legitimate debate. Instead, you have two factions. You have the utopians who believe that let's just pray, or let's just rub our belly and rub our head and put some coconut oil on our earlobes. You have some of the dumbest rituals in the world that mean nothing. They're not going to change, you know, that next water bomb hitting Dallas. And by the way, I just saw a photograph and posted it over the weekend. Someone took a picture from, I'm guessing, about 15 miles away from Dallas. And right over all of Dallas was this water bomb. And when a water bomb comes at you, it's not a normal rain or heavy rain or torrential rain. It is a massive amount of water. There's no place for the water to go. You also have the phenomenon now where water's coming up. There is no more room in the ground. It's coming up, and it's flooding out the seeds. It's going into septic systems. It's flooding septic systems. It's destabilizing foundations of normal people's homes. This is happening in North Carolina. It's happening in Florida. So the government and mainstream media have strong incentives to make every effort to convince the public that what? That there's no reason to be deeply bothered by these unfolding events unless, of course, you're a victim of extreme weather. The corporate media, at the behest of its private industrial partners and sponsors, is every bit complicit in promulgating rampant climate change denialism, as is the Trump White House. The billionaires in Silicon Valley and their legions of tech-savvy clones couldn't give a damn about the destruction of the planet. Rather, they bank on a techno-fantasia scenario to leave the planet and colonize the moon or Mars or somewhere in another star system. It's stupid, but they believe it. It's easy to point fingers at the Republican Party, the Koch brothers, and their network of militant libertarians and the Republican supporters and the fossil fuel and agrochemical giants. Nevertheless, a third of the corporate entrenched Democrats campaigning for the White House, including Joe Biden, do not make the climate a top priority. And when they do offer solutions, it's always a capitalist corporate private public interest solution, meaning it's going to cost a lot of money to make a lot of people very rich, and the solution's not going to work. And by the way, the situation is worse among other Democrat leaders in the legislative branch who are not running. Public calls for a drastic reinvestment of the national budget to prepare for a climate meltdown, we are told, would thoroughly upset the balance of economic power and commerce upon which the nation's gross domestic product and corporate globalization depends. Federal budgeting must be diverted away from the military complex. They're not going to allow that. Away from Big Agra and all of the support of the fossil fuel industry. And that's not going to happen. They're not going to allow those subsidies to be taken away. And therefore, financial protections and incentives and subsidies provided to those industries contributing most to the climate crisis will not be reinvested in any form of green Marshall Plan or Green New Deal. Unfortunately, these radical, albeit necessary, solutions are marginalized as idealist dreams. They're not idealist. They're pragmatic. None of them are being taken seriously enough to be introduced into legislative committees and boardrooms for honest and genuine deliberation. And it may be a losing proposition. More than 200 of the largest corporations estimate $1 trillion in expenditures and losses directly due to climate change within the next 5 years. A report released by the Carbon Disclosure Project credits this corporate loss to a negligent undermining of the impacts climate change will have on businesses and economic growth. Estimated costs for the proposed new Green Deal or any other viable solution vary enormously and are based upon the divide between capitalist forces of corporate interest and those sensitive to the high probability of cultural and environmental collapse. On the capitalist side, represented by Wall Street and the Koch brothers and their corporate allies, both the Democrats and Republicans, Fortune magazine estimates they're going to have to spend $93 trillion. More liberal estimates range $8 to $12 trillion. The conflict is that the status quo of the financial sector is motivated solely by investing in industries where there's the greatest growth potential and highest return. For example, what if you're a retired school teacher and you're living off pension, retired police officer, firefighter? Would you say do not invest, actually divest, if that money is giving us a good return, but it's in a polluting industry? Or would you say, no, I want that extra benefit. I want that extra money. That's part of the problem that we're faced with. Furthermore, the power and the bank accounts of corporate lobbying is derailing any attempts to address the crisis. They control the media. They control the think tanks. They control the foundations. They control even the professors, many of whom take money from these groups, or the fossil fuel and agricultural industries. Armies of lobbyists are all aggressive. Then there are many other unsustainable industries depending upon the energy provided by oil and natural gas to keep production churning. A joint study out of the University of Chicago and the University of California at Santa Barbara determined that the polarized disconnect between what needs to be done and what is actually being accomplished is due to the success of lobbying efforts to assure obstacles impede policy action. Perhaps the most glaring example was opposition to the 2009-10 Waxman-Markey bill or the American Clean Energy and Security Act, regarded as potentially the most effective bill to date. Private industry spent $700 million to lobby against it. The Chicago study found that the amount spent by companies was proportional to how much they were anticipated to gain or lose on the stock market. Now, that's only the first third of our article. We're going to keep it at that for today, and we're going to take a break and come back with my guest. Please stay with us. We're going over by Skype to say hello to David Renton, R-E-N-T-O-N. I gave you his biography at the beginning of the program, and we're going to talk about the rise of the new authoritarians. Nice to have you with us today, David.
Oh, thanks so much, Gary. Can you hear me all right there?
We can hear you fine. Often right-wing political ideologies get confused with neoliberalism, which emphasizes the freedoms of the private corporate sector. For example, policies to deregulate and downsize central government. And in the past, we might have identified Ronald Reagan as a classic right-wing neoliberal, and then later the Bush-Cheney administration, all neoliberals, and then Margaret Thatcher in the United Kingdom that followed this model. Even Bill and Hillary Clinton, who succeeded in pushing through a lot of deregulation, like the Glass-Steagall Act, for example, that we are still feeling the consequences of today, could be representative of this neoliberal view. In addition, authoritarianism is often associated with fascism. However, today, you observe a shift away from conventional neoliberalism towards a radicalized populism and nationalism with strong racist undercurrents. Ukraine comes to mind. We certainly witness this in Trump and a notable segment of his most hardened supporters. And we're witnessing this rise in authoritarian leaders in France, United Kingdom, Austria, and European countries. So please take your time and explain this shift from a neoliberal authoritarianism to this new phenomena you believe we are all experiencing today. The forum is yours.
Thank you. I suppose the starting point is when we talk about neoliberalism. I mean, as you say, neoliberalism's got a history. To me, it starts in 1979, 1980. You referred to the elections of Reagan and Thatcher in those 2 years. Sometimes people use the phrase vanguard neoliberalism to talk about the neoliberalism that dominated the next 10 years or so. By stage two, then, is probably by around the late 1990s, when America's kind of exceptional in the world pattern, because by that stage, most of the neoliberal governments around the world, certainly, for example, Britain, but most European states, for example, you get a different stage of neoliberalism, where neoliberalism is accompanied by a willingness to accept social reforms. You could call that social neoliberalism. And so the outstanding figure in the typical figure in that period is someone like Tony Blair. And you could perhaps put Obama in the same sort of trajectory. So that carries on really till about 2008. But then obviously in 2008, we have the world economic crash. That lasts acutely for a year or two. It lasts in some countries in a slower form for 5, 6, 7 years afterwards. Certainly in Britain, it's even the case today, as late as 2019, that our real wages, in fact, let alone our real wages, our actual wages are still lower than they were in 2008, which hadn't happened in Britain at any time since the 18th century. So we saw a really sharp fall in living standards, and lots of other countries did too. So what's happened in terms of post-2008 and the reinvention of neoliberalism? The immediate response, you know, as everyone knows, is that there's a period of kind of, you could call it in Britain, the dominant term that's used was austerity. So the answer to any sort of economic crisis was just to cut everything, make the budgets match. And that's led in Britain to an absolute decimation of our welfare services and massive cuts in the public sector and so on. And again, that's been the pattern in lots of places. It's not the pattern, say, in China. It's a pattern to some extent in America. It's been the pattern pretty well all over Europe and many other regions of the world too. But really, what my book's about isn't about any of those things which have happened. It's about what's come next. And I suppose what I'm arguing is that in the aftermath of 2008, old-school neoliberalism essentially lost its appeal to large amounts of the commercial, political, etc. elites, that it just became obvious to them that as a form of politics, it wasn't going to win them elections. Because essentially what it said to voters was, there are all sorts of things that you rely on and you're going to have less of them in future. Now, as long as voters were saying, thinking to themselves, well, someone else is going to get hit by this, they kind of went along with it. But by now, that message has just plainly become absolutely electoral arsenic. So we have a situation instead where today, in terms of the old ideas of neoliberalism, that essentially the classical economics, essentially the cuts to welfare, essentially the privatisation, etc., right throughout the world, there are very, very few centre-right-wing parties that still stand on those programmes. I mean, I was listening to your section earlier with pleasure, and I heard you talking about the Koch brothers. The important point is the Koch brothers don't represent mainstream thinking in the centre-right in more than a handful of countries worldwide at the moment. The dominant approach now is rather to say we can have social welfare, we can expand the welfare state, we can increase the amount of government spending, but we can only do this by excluding certain people. And those people might be Muslims, they might be migrants. So it's a different kind of approach to politics. It's much more nationalistic. It's much more, divides the world much more into races. It's willing to expand rather than reduce funding or state funding. But all the time, what it comes back to is that, you know, it comes back to things which have actually were always there in neoliberalism. You know, Reagan and Thatcher had their racialized policies. But what's happened is that which was there, which was a minor part of the original wave of neoliberalism, has become the dominant form, and everything else is shaped and pulled by it. So in a sense, from Trump, what are the distinctive Trump policies? Now, and I'm saying Trump really is not just an American figure, but a figure whose typical developments around the world. I'd say the two typical Trump policies at the moment are, one, the trade wars, and two, in terms of the border policies and the policies in relation to Mexico, etc. Those are the things which define the regime. and they pull everything else behind them. So we've got a much more aggressive and militant form of right-wing politics. And I suppose the last thing I want to say is, and this is the key theme of my book, is that, you know, there are all sorts of people, particularly in the States, who are worried, you know, does this mean if we're seeing a return to nationalism, protection, to a world of tariffs and borders and really intense trade wars, does that mean that we're returning to the 30s and fascism? And I suppose the argument of my book is that probably no, we're not. And we're not essentially because all these parties are still willing to accept existing state institutions, play conventional politics. They're not trying to have a war against the state. But that's not necessarily a particularly cheerful message, because it means that what I'm still saying is that we're going into a period of right-wing advance and militancy, which is going to see all sorts of negative things for the lives of all sorts of people, for working class people, for migrants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you. I appreciate that overview. In my opinion, there's been a flurry of articles and books that have dealt with the increase in hatred in the world. Matt Taibbi's recent book on how the media intentionally generates division between people, leading to hatred and violence, is just one example. But I do not think the United States has been so divided by ideologies that they want to actually inflict violence upon each other since perhaps the Civil War. So what is it about this new authoritarian trend that won't hesitate to resort to violence? And also, this is not one of just the Republicans. Look at the violence that was put upon Libya and Gaddafi when he represented no real or existential threat to the world. In fact, he was the anchor for stability and prosperity and education and freedoms in Africa. And then look at the other countries where we have intentionally intervened. These have been under both Democrat and Republicans, but they're all beholden to the military-industrial complex, of which there are more than 200,000 contractors in Washington, D.C. alone. And your country and your David Cameron and others, Theresa May, have supported this kind of violence. What does it say when people are so willing to bring violence to other people using some false pretense of bringing freedom and prosperity and democracy when nothing could be further from the truth?
Well, I suppose what you're asking me is a question which I think progressive people all around the world have been asking themselves since Trump got in, which is how much has changed since 2016 and how much are we still living under the old? And that isn't to glorify the old, but it's just trying to, you need to have a real sense of that. Now, when you talk about the violence, I think that you have to distinguish between the violence which states in Europe or in America inflict on other countries and the violence which takes place within countries. This isn't a pleasant thought, but the truth is that for several hundred years, countries like Britain, countries like America have applied violence continuously, consistently against the countries, you can call them the global south, the periphery, whatever you want to call them. They've been the victims of colonialism, of imperialism, of et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that process has gone on an awful long time. I'm in no way trying to minimize the brutality that's inflicted. At other times in my life, for example, one of the books that I wrote 15 years ago was a history of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Now, the Congo is probably the country in the world which has seen the most violence caused by outsiders, with high points, including a Belgian imperial intervention at the start of the 20th century, which killed 20 million people, and runs right up to a series of civil wars in the last 15 years, in which between 5 and 10 million people have died. So, you know, this is part of human history, and we have to accept it, and this is a fundamental fact. But what I'm trying to talk about in this book is a different set of processes. It's about what happens when that violence, which has been normalized in terms of the relationships between what we used to call the first and the third world, and that's been there for a long time, what happens when that violence starts coming to the center and starts infecting the relationships here? And obviously here I'm shaped, you know, it's not a large part of my book, but I'm very conscious of the very large number of thinkers from the third world, Fanon, Lumumba, et cetera, who argued many, many times, if you allow the violence of international violence to continue, you will see domestic violence. Now, the point is, I suppose, that we're living in a moment where that return of the violence, or what Malcolm X called at one stage of his life, you know, the chickens coming home to roost. We're seeing that happen here, that there's been a cycle of imperial violence. It started in the mid-1980s. Obviously, after Vietnam, there was a lull in it for about 15 years, but it started again in the mid-1980s, and it's become more intense up to Iraq. But what happens when that violence comes home? What happens when, for example, because politicians of the right and the left have been saying for such a long time that Muslims in the Third World are fair game for imperial intervention, what happens when you start practicing that violence against Muslims in the US and in Europe? And what happens at a certain point, and I suppose it's only now that I feel I can answer your question directly, what that happens at a certain point is societies change. You know, that we stop, we all look at ourselves and we think, you know, we live under democracy, we live under relatively liberal societies, we have relatively decent standards of living, yet there are some losers, but most people are all right. And we're satisfied morally with how our societies are. But what's been happening the last 3 or 4 years is you see the signs of those rules starting to break down, and things which were considered unacceptable suddenly becoming the norm. So I'll just give you one example that say, you know, for people watching American politics from the outside, was shocking. When Donald Trump in the 2000 election started saying, you know, if I get in, you know, I'm going to jail Hillary Clinton, started hinting in some of his speeches, it'd be completely legitimate if defenders of gun rights were to take a shot at Hillary Clinton. Anyone with any sense of history started to think, this has broken some rules. This isn't how democracies behave. Something's starting to change. And if this carries on changing in the same way, the only possible result is going to be very, very bad indeed.
Okay, my final question deals with, there is right now an enormous shift in Latin America in support of authoritarian governments, such as Bolsonaro in Brazil and Mujica Macri in Argentina. Why?
I know. I mean, I don't personally start from Latin America, although that's part of it. I mean, I'd start from a region of the world which I know much better, which is the Middle East, which I've been traveling to myself personally for many years. And I've known activists there for many, many years and has seen exactly the same change at exactly the same time. You know, today, for example, the elected president of Egypt, the only elected president in the country's history, died in a courtroom under trial where he was being tried by the supporters of a military regime, which came in about 6 or 7 years ago now. I think you've just got to say that there are cycles, there are moments when people who are the advocates of democracy are winning, and there are moments, unfortunately, when our people are losing. And when we lose, we don't tend to lose in just one country. We tend to lose in whole parts of the world all at once. And again, the depressing thought is that we're just, unfortunately, in one of those moments right now.
Hmm. David, thank you very much for being on. And also, hopefully, people read The New Authoritarians, Convergence on the Right, which exposes a deeply disturbing trend in the rise of a new right-wing radicalism that is gaining strength in the United States and UK and France and in other places. And even when I saw a recent documentary on one of the people who was an architect of this and was a top advisor to Donald Trump, and he was out there showing that he was starting a whole new radicalized campaign in Europe. And that's unfortunate that we're not paying attention to all this because it's growing. So thank you for educating us and bringing us this information.
That's an absolute pleasure, Gary. Take care.
Bye. Okay, and that's my Steve Bannon was who I was referring to. And that's my guest, David Renton, R-E-N-T-O-N, a British barrister and specialist in this issue. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you very much for listening in. And remember, I'll be doing my webinar this coming Sunday at noon, and it's a very important one. You won't want to miss it, because I've taken my entire lifetime of work in anti-aging research, and I'm giving you all the best of how you can reverse diseases and turn back the clock, literally and figuratively, where your body can change and become younger again. I'm very optimistic about what's happening in anti-aging work. So go to GaryNoll.com or go to PRN.fm and take a look, and you'll see what we're doing on this anti-aging webinar starting at noon this coming Sunday. Have a nice day, everyone.